This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. On our program, we spotlight the art and science of peacemaking throughout history and in our lives today. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. In 2009, I was watching the PBS television series We Shall Remain, 5 parts on key moments in Native American history. The first episode opened with dramatized scenes of what's come to be known as the First Thanksgiving in Plymouth Colony, what would later become Massachusetts.
Almost nothing is known about the most iconic feast in American history, not even the date. It happened most likely in the late summer of 1621, a little less than a year after the Wampanoag saw a small group of strangers land on their shores. Half these strangers, men, women, and children, had died of disease, hunger, or exposure in their first winter on the unforgiving edge of North America. But by the next summer, with the help of the Wampanoag, the Pilgrims had taken a harvest sure to sustain the settlement through the next barren season. And they meant to celebrate their faith that God had smiled on their endeavor. As the Thanksgiving began, a group of Wampanoag men, led by their chief, Massasoit, entered the Plymouth settlement, not entirely sure of the reception they'd get.
In 2010, I talked with the episode's director, Chris Eyre, who'd been charged with imagining what the feast might have looked like. Coincidentally, the night before we talked, he caught a rebroadcast of the episode on his local station. I saw on the website that historians have only been able to find about 2 lines of a reference even to First Thanksgiving.
Isn't that incredible?
How did you manage to shape your depiction of the event from that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's amazing to me that there are only, you know, 2 lines of reference to the most historic, patriotic dinner that this country has ever had, which is the first Thanksgiving and the Thanksgivings after that. So, you know, there's not much to go on historically at all in terms of the first Thanksgiving. You know, there are a lot of depictions of it in, you know, cartoons and children's books, coloring books. But as far as the reality of it, you know, what is the reality of that? You know, we took the 2 lines and basically said, okay, out of this, we can, you know, extrapolate that there were indigenous foods, beans and rice and wild turkey, probably some deer. And, you know, there was a menu made through our historians and production. And then we just started to build from, you know, what state was the settlement in. So then it becomes very organic, almost like an acting workshop, you know, in which you get these actors together and you're directing and you have all the pieces and components and, you know, you think, okay, do they sit down? Do some of them sit down? Do they stand around? You know, what's the mood? Do the settlers try and formalize the situation? Is it, you know, real casual? Are they laughing? Are they interacting? Are the Indians offering their indigenous food? We came up with working with the actors and just kind of playing around with different ideas.
Window, Pao Chow. Pao Chow. Pao Chow. Window, Jake. Window, Pao Chow.
And yet, in your depiction of the Thanksgiving, it seems like anyone, Anglo or Native, who would be watching that, imagining and sharing a wish that the goodness and the sharing had lasted in our history, although it certainly did not. But was the hope of that moment a goal for you to depict finally, and particularly since you just watched it again recently?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my thinking exactly. I mean, when they come and shake hands and then they start to eat, you know, you're hoping that this is all going to be well and good. And so I think where you start to know that, wait a minute, this can't last, and that's where the drama lies.
For those who follow the pilgrims across the Atlantic, the first Thanksgiving would enter into national mythology, where it remains the bright opening chapter of the American creation story. For the Wampanoag and for Massasoit, the memory of that day would recede into darker places, shadowed by betrayal and loss.
A clip from We Shall Remain and the episode After the Mayflower, directed by our guest Chris Eyre. Although the program began with a depiction of the first Thanksgiving, it's really the story of a Wampanoag chief who came to be known as Massasoit, who chose to cooperate with the pilgrims and form an alliance. He struck an agreement that some see as the first peace treaty between Native Americans and British settlers. Others call it a war alliance of convenience to both parties, who needed something the other offered for a time. We'll have more with We Shall Remain director Chris Eyre later, but first, from Plymouth Plantation in Plymouth, Massachusetts, we have on the line with us two Native American scholars of this period in history, Darius Coombs and Bob Charlebois. Welcome to you both. While we want to focus on Massasoit's alliance with the Plymouth colony, what's important to say about the introduction of European settlers to this particular region in the years before 1620 and 1621, when Massasoit chose to engage them? Were there not several decades of contact prior to that, Darius Coombs?
Yeah, and that's very important to mention, because you think of 1620, and a lot of people think first people here, aside from Native people. But we had people coming over minimum 100 years prior. There were Dutch people coming over, they're English, and they're French. The first written recording of people coming was a man named Verrazano, who landed down in Rhode Island and traded with the Narragansett down there. But most likely there were people coming over long before that even. They didn't really care about the land. They wanted to do business. They wanted beaver pelts. They wanted otter pelts. And they also wanted people. And there were ships coming over taking Native people back over to Europe and teaching them their language, parts of their culture, then bringing them back over as guides and interpreters. So land wasn't a big deal for them.
Right, and so the difference in those earlier years is that we're not talking about settlements per se.
No, the bigness made it a little favorable when the colonists landed here in 1620, because when they came, they brought women and children along, and there were the traders who didn't do a lot of nice stuff, you know. So what made them, the colonists, better off for themselves is when they did bring their women and children meant to, in a way, a friendlier type of people.
Well, you could argue that Massasoit had many reasons to distrust or maybe even want to eliminate the settlers based on those experiences with the English in this region, just in the time before the pilgrims landed, because of what you said. You know, they were abducting some Native Americans, enslaving them, taking them back to Europe, bringing disease that decimated some tribes.
That's true. I'll handle this. This is Bob. You know, there was a big fork thrown into this whole thing too, and it was disease. And it's if you refer to the book about Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is was a bestseller for many months prior to this particular settlement, the Plymouth settlement. There were about 4 years before they came. There was an outbreak of what appears to be the bubonic plague, and it started up in Maine, and it went down south in sort of a rayon of death, if you will, all the way through where Boston is now, down to the south coast of Massachusetts, and it would have changed the canvas upon which everything was being painted there. It cut Wampanoag country in two. The survivors of that were on Cape Cod and in the islands, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the Elizabeth Islands, and so forth, and in a little area south of Providence, Rhode Island. That area, which is where the Pokanoket people live, that was Massasoit's people, would have been in a particular quandary, because in normal times they had enough men in their warrior societies to balance out their opponents, their enemies to the west. It would have been the Narragansetts. They had parity in it kept the peace in normal times. But now they had about one-tenth of the amount of men that they had prior to that. So, and as a result, there were forays and rumors being made and so forth by the Narragansetts. They were going to come in and take Massasoit's area. And he was looking for an ace to pull out of his pocket, if you will. And when he had heard that Europeans had arrived in Plymouth, he just, he was very happy. And I think he thought, Europeans, big metal guns, let's make a deal here. So
yeah, I want to get into that a little bit more, but let me ask you to reflect a little bit on Massasoit. What is known about him as a tribal leader before this devastation that you just described, when incredibly, you know, 9 out of 10 of his people were lost to these diseases? One reference book said he always was inclined to peace, even among his own race. Would you agree with that? And is there anything in his story that supports that before this encounter with the Pilgrims?
You know, there's not a whole lot known about Massasoit. There are bits and pieces that are written about him. Massasoit was a revered leader amongst the Wampanoag people. Obviously he was, because he could summon the loyalty of so many communities around him. Politically, they operated in such a way that each individual band or city or town, whatever you want to call it, was independent and was headed by a sachem. He was a very well-loved sachem, and it wasn't based on fear. It was based on love. So we know that about him. Whether or not he was inclined to peace, we're not sure about that, you know. He was inclined to do the best thing for his people at the time, which would have secured their peace and their well-being. I don't know if he was someone who was inclined towards being offensive militarily or anything of that sort, but we don't know. We just don't know.
You hear about Massasoit being a great leader, a great sachem, a great chief, and what people think right off the bat is, oh, he was a great chief of all the Wampanoag people. At the time, you look at over 70 Wampanoag communities. And he, as far as we know, he was only the leader of one community, and that was Pokanoket, which was located on the border of the Narragansett people. And as Bob was saying, the Narragansett, after the plague had happened, decided to start attacking Massasoit's community and start taking over. And so he was smart enough to come out here in the spring of 1621 to Plymouth Colony and make a war alliance. I wouldn't even call it a peace alliance. It was more or less like a war alliance with the colonists. Before, a Narragansett chief most likely would have been Canonicus, so had that alliance going on to help fight off the Narragansett people. But there's no sign of him governing all 70 Wampanoag communities. He probably had influence, but there's no sign of him having been the supreme sachem.
Mm-hmm. So he started to observe this Plymouth community from the outskirts in the winter of 1620. Let's remind listeners, what was the state of the Plymouth community when the Mayflower that brought them there sailed back to England in the winter of 1620?
Well, they had landed. Well, they didn't first land in what is called Plymouth today. That's one big thing people have to understand. They landed a place which is called East Ham down Cape Cod. It has always been a Wampanoag community called Nauset. And unfortunately for them, what had happened in 1614, there was a ship that came over which landed down there, took 7 Nauset as slaves. So when the colonists landed down there in 1620, they were scouting out the land, thinking about staying. But the Nauset came out to the beach and said, hey, for one thing, we really don't get along with you guys because of slavery that's happened prior. And also, we live here. And there was a small skirmish going on at the beach at that time, and that's basically when they were forced out. And that's when they came down to what is called Plymouth today. We call it Patuxent, and that's always been the Wampanoag community located around here. So when they landed here, there was nobody around here at all. This whole area, as far as we know, was wiped out from that disease. The nearest living native community was about 15 miles inland, a town which is called Middleborough today, and what we call Namasket. And yeah, there were signs that Massasoit knew about the people being out here. They would hear native people outside their village, or there's documents of that. But the first time there was a native person going into the Pilgrim village was in March of 1621. And that's when a chief went into the village. It wasn't a Wampanoag chief. It was a chief from up in Maine. His name was Samoset. He came down earlier with a trade ship and was let loose pretty much. And Massasoit, being a smart man, he wasn't dumb, said, Samoset, you're a leader. you're a sachem, you're a chief, you know how to speak English, you dealt with these people before, why don't you go into that village and see what's going on? And Samoset walked into the Plymouth Colony in March of 1621 with just a breechcloth on, when that's just like a summer dress. And he told them what had happened, the plague that came through here, asking why they were here. They told him, they sat him down, they fed him, they gave him something to drink. And then he told him, well, I'm not from here, but I'm going to bring you a leader who is familiar with this here, who is from here. And that's when he ran back and told Massasoit, all right, it was all right to come along. And that's when he brought himself and 60 of his men.
Mm-hmm. But this was after a brutal winter for these colonists. They lost a lot of people. I understand something like, 15 of 19 women died?
The numbers that we have indicate that half of them perished. From the original 102, it was exactly 51 that were left.
And so the fact that they were in a weakened position, the fact that they had women and children, this all emboldened Massasoit not to see them as a threat and to encourage this encounter.
I guess you could surmise that, but he also was looking for closure, actually for an out on his situation with the Narragansetts. That was an overwhelming factor, I think. He wanted to protect his people from being hegemonized, if you will, by the Narragansetts, by usurping his power, and he not only his power but the safety of his people. You know, as it turned out, it wasn't a rosy, happy situation in which everybody sat around, as we mention nowadays, and ate turkey or whatever. And this was a business agreement. And the colonists felt they needed protection. They were in the New World, what they call the New World, and they were in a foreign place. They didn't know what to make of these people, and they needed security, as did the Pokanoket Wampanoags from the Narragansetts.
My king welcomes you here.
Kana naman kwetatawa wasame sasi ogi yu.
This is one of the very first of these treaty encounters that are going to become such an important part of Anglo-American relations with Indian peoples across the continent.
We want to be at peace with you. We want you to promise that none of your people will harm any of our people.
Uten kakantam on Kenya. One day, Nashby Ninoa.
Anunas mata no was iaona nog.
Let us agree then that if anyone unjustly attack you, then we will help you. And if anyone unjustly attack us, then you will help us.
The treaty negotiation scene as presented in the PBS series We Shall Remain. Let me read the points of this agreement as recalled in a memoir written by William Bradford, who for many, many years was the governor of Plymouth Colony. It says, after friendly entertainment and some gifts given to him, the settlers made peace with him, which hath now continued this 24 years at the time of this writing, in these terms. Number one, that neither he nor any of his should injure or do hurt to any of their people. Number two, that if any of his did any hurt to any of theirs, he should send the offender that they might punish him. Number three, that if anything were taken away from any of theirs, he should cause it to be restored, and that they should do the like to his. Number four, that if any did unjustly war against him, that they would aid him, and if any did war against them, he would aid them. Number five, that he should send to his neighbors confederates to certify them of this, that they might not wrong them, but might be likewise compromised in the conditions of peace. And number six, that when their men came to them, they should leave their bows and arrows behind them. Darius Coombs, what more do we know about the composing of this document that ended up standing for 40 years?
It was composed in March of 1621, early when Samoset went back to Pokanoket and told Massasoit it was all right to come along with his men, in which he did, and that was later on in March of 1621. He came himself and his brother, being Quatequina, and 60 other warriors. And that's when they sat down and made that very famous war treaty. I stress war treaty because it really wasn't a peace treaty. You're talking about two different people, totally. One thinking one side and the other thinking another, you know. Friendship is even a strong word to use back then. You hear that a lot. Languages were different. Cultures were different. It was hard enough to understand each other than have be friends. But that's when that very famous treaty was established. And the biggest, you got the 6 points, and a lot of the points is leave your bows and arrows outside the village. Well, if you come to a native place, you leave your muskets outside. But the main point of the treaty was if you go to war, I will help you out. And if I go to war, you help me out. Aside from that, we're going to keep separate lives.
We'll have more with our guests, Plymouth Plantation Native American scholars Darius Coombs and Bob Charlebois, in a moment. Also more later with director Chris Eyre, who helped create several episodes in the PBS We Shall Remain series, including this one that focused on the story of Wampanoag Chief Massasoit and his 40-year alliance with the British settlers of Plymouth Colony. Was it a peace treaty or a war alliance? And does that distinction matter in parsing out this early effort at cooperation and tolerance? More after this break. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We're online with scores of episodes in our series at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're exploring a treaty agreement made in 1621 between Native American Chief Massasoit and the English settlers of Plymouth Plantation. Whether called a peace pact or a strategic alliance, the cooperation set forth in the agreement lasted about 40 years, until after Massasoit's death. Our guests are Native American scholars Darius Coombs and Bob Charlebois, both speaking to us from Plymouth Plantation, an educational museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Later we'll hear more from Native American film director Chris Eyre, who worked on several episodes of the 2009 PBS documentary series We Shall Remain, including the episode called After the Mayflower, which featured the story of Massasoit. Let me ask Bob Charlebois, in the years following the 1621 agreement, how did the settlers end up aiding Massasoit and vice versa? Were there instances when the treaty was actually put into practice?
There were a few, and it was evident in those instances where that occurred that the might of the English was shown. Massasoit was correct. You know, the weapons were a very powerful tool to those unacquainted with them. That would have been the native people here. In convincing them of the might of the English, of the Europeans with their big metal weapons and so forth, when used in anger, there had been testing of the political waters between Canonicus, who was a Narragansett sachem, and another sachem of the Wampanoag who lived in the area around New Bedford, Massachusetts. His name was Combatant. And he had been dead set against any treaty with the English and to begin with. And they had actually kidnapped Massasoit, were holding him. What eventually happened was that the English showed their military might and killed and wounded a number of people in one of the villages that it was opposed to the treaty and so forth. And they extracted not only the acknowledgement of their might, but also extracted an oath of fealty to the King of England. And that's one of the things that was a little bit underhanded, actually, but actually quite underhanded. The English, after showing their military might on several occasions, would have used that as a way to extract an oath of allegiance. They didn't do that to Massasoit. You don't see it anywhere in that 6-point document. However, they would have used it to anybody who was opposed, to that, with that treaty. They later on could incorporate English common law. And that's a whole different can of worms there.
So Darius called it a war treaty. Many characterizations of it have focused on it as a peace document. What do you think, if anything, is remarkable about the conditions that were negotiated between these two communities?
You know, the six very basic points, as with all things in matters political or diplomatic or something, you operate from, it's almost like a card game. You're operating from your strength, or I should say a chess game rather, your strength versus strength. And I think Massasoit felt that his liaison with the English, or his relationship to the English, would have guaranteed the security of his people. I think that the English themselves, or the common English person, probably felt the same.
Did the negotiation of these points, though, lead to anything that wouldn't have happened otherwise, like integration of the cultures in any way, or learning of each other, acceptance of each other, that might not have happened if it hadn't been manufactured?
I would have to say no, not because you're talking about, like I was saying, not two totally different cultures. If anything at all, this treaty was just a more or less like a war treaty. And when you have treaties like that, you don't really have to be friends with the people. It's a business agreement, basically, and that's what it was.
The Pilgrims were in a kind of a different lot. They didn't call themselves Pilgrims, for one thing, but they had separated from the Reformed Church, the Puritan Church, rather, back in England and so forth. They were a very insular people. They wouldn't have been open to dealing with native people. They, when you come here to Plymouth Plantation, you'll see a huge palisade around the whole thing, and it makes one wonder. It's a food for thought item. Why did they need it? They were obviously afraid of the unknown, and who wouldn't be, you know? They had come from thousands of miles away into a very different world. They were in a situation where they needed native allies. They needed some protection from basically from the unknown. They had no idea what awaited them out there, and that would have been the driving force to that that alliance. Massasoit, to be all honest with you, he was in a bind. He was in a bind more than the Pilgrims were in a bind, actually, and as it turned out, you know, they were ascendant in the whole deal. They became the Massachusetts Bay Colony when coupled up together with the Puritan fathers up in Boston and so forth. And
right, well, their numbers swelled from 300 to 20,000 with the addition of those colonies, and the power balance started to change, right? The British weren't as interested in keeping any peace or even entering into a war alliance.
No, it was a moot point. It had outlived its purpose, and it had far outlived its purpose. And as such, they didn't need the Wampanoags. And if you look at the history from about 1620 to 1623, in three very important years in the colony, you can see that Massasoit had gone from a position of desperation to one where he had basically eliminated all of the native enemies of his people, and he had a measure of security. And what happened was that he basically put himself and his people, meaning collectively all of the Wampanoag people, in a position to be the only one left for the colonists to have to contend with, you know? And later colonists did not have any loyalty or feeling of gratitude to any native people. And that's, I think that's sort of the lead up towards King Philip's War.
Yeah, you got the first generation pretty much on both sides in a way that pretty much tolerated each other. Tolerated and would probably be a good word to use for back then. But you had the second generation on both sides that really couldn't stand each other. More and more people coming over, more and more people are taking up land. One side believed in ownership of land, and the other side didn't. And once you have that big, big difference in the way of thinking, eventually you're going to have war, and that's what basically happened in 1676. 1675, I should say.
This is after Massasoit's death, his son, Philip.
Well, Massasoit himself, he led the Pokanokets all the way up to 1660 until his death, yeah. And who took over leadership after him, how leadership was passed on was normally from father to son. So his oldest son took over, being Warm Sutter. Europeans called him Alexander. What happened in 1662, the colonists invited Alexander Warm Sider to come out to have a meeting, and which he did. He came to Plymouth Colony, and he sat down, met with them about different policies, gave him something to drink, something to eat. And after a while, he goes, well, I'm going to head back to Poconoke. He's with his men. He went back, and halfway back to Poconoke, he died. So if you put two and two together, you pretty much get an idea what happened to him. And who took over leadership after Warm Sutter was his younger brother, Metacomet. And what the Europeans called him was King Philip. See, what happened back then, if you're a person of high stature, like a chief, European name people will give you names of high stature, so they'll call you a king. So they called him King Philip. And King Philip really wasn't hearing much of anything. He was pretty much fed up, you know. And still today, the King Philip's War is considered to be the bloodiest war per capita in New England. And that involved numerous nations around the people, around the area, going against the English.
Right. Well, what feels like the take-home message to learn from considering this particular story in terms of peacemaking philosophy that could inform people who care about peacemaking?
Well, personally, I don't think we should abandon the effort to make peace in the world. I think it's important. I think I'd have to hang up my cleat, so to speak, if I did. I felt it about that way. But I think this is just another example of how wars are in modern times. You know, and probably from the time that since humans were waging war, you know, when they were throwing sticks and stones at each other, they've always had their interests at heart. You know, whether it was a carcass of an animal or, the furtherance of their people. And I think that that's what was going on here. I think we have to rise above that, though. I think human beings have to rise above that, and there has to be a trade-off somewhere where we say, if we really want peace, then we've got to make a concerted effort to sit down, as the Iroquois would say, under the tree of peace, and we talk, you know. What we're doing right now is very important. The dialogue is all important, the realistic dialogue and laying everything out on the table. I think that's more important than anything. Shows like this, for instance, I think are essential to understanding and telling the truth. And what's so bad about the truth? We shouldn't be afraid of the truth. We should bring it out, and we can go from there. We can work on it, you know. It's like we were saying before we started this, we were talking about South Africa and about how, after apartheid fell, they had reconciliation commissions and so forth. Boers and Zulus would sit there, or Bantu rather, people, and talk about what they had done. And they may not have come away all huggy and kissy, but at least they had a good understanding, and they could put it behind them and then go forth into the future, you know. So it's a very, very complex subject, you know. What happened after King Philip's War, it set the tone for so many other wars that happened in North America between Native people and Europeans. And it was the model that was used, you know. So it was the model by which Europeans and later the United States went from the East Coast to the Pacific. Make a treaty, break it, and it's sort of a two steps forward, one step back process, and they kept doing it back and forth and back and forth. Whether you're looking at the history of the treaties with the Lakota Nation, or the wars against the Apaches or the Comanches in Texas, or the Shawnee, which is an all and we shall remain, you know. And you know, it's got to be laid out there. It's got to be understood as to what happened, you know. That dialogue is all important. I'm a big dialogue guy.
Bob Charlebois and Darius Coombs are both Native American scholars affiliated with the Plymouth Plantation Museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts, from where they spoke to us. In a moment, more on the Massasoit story with film director Chris Eyre when we return on Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Back in a minute. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We're online with scores of episodes in our series at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're focusing on this moment in history in 1621 when a Native American chief, Wampanoag leader Massasoit, came to terms with the nascent British colonists at Plymouth to cooperate with each other and protect each other. A six-point treaty lasted for 40 years before Massasoit's death and the subsequent outbreak of the bloody King Philip's War between the Native American tribes and the British that ultimately resulted in the deaths of some 600 colonists and as many as 3,000 Native Americans from war and disease. Cheyenne Arapaho film director Chris Eyre, known for his movies Smoke Signals and Skins and Skinwalkers, also directed several installments in the five-part PBS series We Shall Remain, which you can view, by the way, via a link on our website, peacetalksradio.com. I talked more with Chris about his telling of the tale of Massasoit in the series' first episode, After the Mayflower, which featured dramatic reenactments of the history paired with commentary from scholars of those times.
There's a very clear sense that Massasoit understands the entire treaty as reciprocal. At the very end of the treaty, it says, if you do these things, then King James will esteem you his friend and ally. So it would make very good sense for the Indians to think this is an alliance. This is a meeting between friends.
That was historian Jenny Hale Pulsifer, who interprets Massasoit's outreach as saying, we're the same people now. Plymouth Plantation native historian Darius Coombs, whom we spoke with earlier, might disagree with that, saying how different the cultures were, how they would never be the same people. He said at best they tolerated each other. Chris Eyre, without a written record of Massasoit's thinking, are we sort of destined to see it through either the hopeful or skeptical filter of a particular historian, do you think?
I hope not. That's my greatest hope, is that we embrace the gray areas in our history, in that we don't, you know, demonize what we don't understand or believe in, and that at the same, you know, time, we don't, you know, aren't so blind that we just see only what we see and exalt that too. I mean, like I said, We Shall Remain, you know, not to get off the After the Mayflower with Massasoit, but, you know, in the case of Wes Studi's character in the Cherokee movie, he had always been taught that the character of Major Ridge was the villain to Cherokee people. And Wes commented to me that he appreciated playing this character that was supposedly a villain because he never thinks of his characters as bad. He always plays them as good. And that goes for, you know, his role in Last of the Mohicans, which was Magua, who was this, you know, complete terror in Last of the Mohicans. And I think that it's the same with Massasoit. It's the same with King Philip. It's the same with the settlers. I mean, the settlers, I'm sitting there watching the series last night. When these, you know, ships are coming across the ocean and they land at Plymouth and people get out, they're not thinking, hey, we'd like to kill people. I mean, it's not that black and white. They're thinking they'd like a better life than what they left. And I always think to myself, you know, I don't know what the component is that turns it into crimes of war, but it's just an interesting subject that I hope that we never stop asking the question and pondering what choices we would have made had we been in the same shoes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you specifically, what did you hope to leave the viewers with in your portrayal of Massasoit? I think you kind of answered it there, but can you apply specifically, you know, with this particular character, this sort of nuanced approach that it sounds like you were trying to apply to all characters in this series?
I mean, what I try and do is apply, you know, the rock and the hard place allegory, which is, you know, whether you're a farmer in this country or whether you're a, you know, out of work salesperson in this country, I try to apply the statement or the idea that it could happen to anyone and that we shouldn't be so quick with our judgments as to right and wrong. Sometimes there are circumstances. And in the case of the American Native American, you know, conflict that happened then or that happens now, it's not driven by evil people, I don't think, all the time. It's driven by misinformation. It's driven by politics. It's driven by populace. It's driven by money. But I don't think its core is, you know, evil people or bad people. I think it's about people that are segregated, and each group of people are trying to exist, trying to live, trying to get ahead. So, you know, when I'm portraying Massasoit or I'm portraying pilgrims in this case, if I get into the gray areas with representation of anybody, then I'm happy. If the character comes out black or white, I think that that's too easy. And so, you know, with Massasoit, he was a gentleman who was caught between a rock and a hard place. He had some incredibly difficult decisions to make, such as a peace treaty, such as should he have done something to stop people in the very beginning. He was a man who made a lot of choices because of the shoes he was in, and I don't think it's fair to go back and say he made wrong or right choices. He was somebody who was doing the best he could do given the circumstance, and maybe the circumstance didn't allow for anything else at that time. Who knows?
Have you always been an empathetic person?
I think so. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, when I design characters, I'm empathizing with, you know, the characters and their conflicts. And, you know, if it's going to be committed to screen, television or film, certainly this person is in a situation, a conflict that's worth being told. Hopefully it is. You know, hopefully it is. Hopefully I haven't picked some characters that aren't, you know, worthy of stories in mass media. But, you know, I always empathize with the characters. Anything I make, that's really the key as a storyteller for me. You know, they're flesh and bone, and that they're in this situation that they're trying to figure out.
You've already disclaimed yourself as not a scholar, but I'm curious still about your take on this particular story because of this debate about whether or not it really was a moment of peace to celebrate or reflect on. How do you feel about it as you sort of look back on the 40 years of sustained, if tenuous, peace that Massasoit was able to, along with certain leaders of the British colony, maintain?
My take is that it's a tribute to Massasoit's leadership that there was a 40-year place of peace. I think that's a tribute to his leadership. I mean, you know, we came down to this same conflict over and over and over again in the We Shall Remain series, which was, again, you know, I cite the Cherokee story 200 years later, in which the Cherokees were between a rock and a hard place. They were being forced from Georgia to Oklahoma, and there was no good choice. And the leadership of someone like Major Ridge, played by Wes Studi, moved his family and followers to Oklahoma before the onslaught of the Georgia militia, and U.S. troops were committed to the Trail of Tears and to the death of thousands of Cherokees. So the question is, was it progressive that he saw what was happening, and as a leader, he actually moved the people he could before, or was it more progressive to stay and fight with women and children at the expense of Cherokee lives? And those are the kind of questions that we can't quite answer. In the case of Massasoit, I mean, what was the alternative? That he start, you know, killing settlers, I guess. I don't know what the alternative is, you know?
For you, after working on this film, and for viewers after watching it, what do you think is the value in contemplating these fleeting moments of peace and cooperation, however tentative or even self-serving, as some of the historians would say that they might have been?
These moments are all pieces of our past as Americans that we need to not forget in order to go forward. I mean, when we talk about, you know, things like immigration, and we talk about the war in Afghanistan, and we talk about the Middle East, These are all important growing pains that this country's gone through that we need to better understand and make sure that we continue, you know, as America in a good way, as the greatest country in the world. And I think that that's the only way that we can do so is to look at our history and actually own the history that we've been a part of, which we quite, to this point, we quite haven't done. But, you know, these are important lessons that we look at and we say, hey, you know, we've been here before. You know, in the case of Massasoit and King Philip, I mean, I just had no idea about the Northeastern Indians and how the touchstone of Plymouth, you know, set off the expansion and manifest destiny of the entire continent. And so, you know, to be able to immerse myself in that for, you know, a long period of time, almost a year, it was just amazing to me. It was like an epiphany in terms of, okay, this is where it all started.
I read that you had half a dozen consultants on site as you shot. Now, was processing this discussion ever a challenge in settling on a portrayal in the film?
You know, I mean, for my part, as the director, I'm more interested in terms of character study and trying to make Massasoit. In this case, it was a gentleman, Marcos Ackerman, who played Massasoit. And Marcos unfortunately passed away about a month ago. Last night, I watched the series again. Well, actually, the first of the five-part series, which is After the Mayflower. And, you know, kind of raised my hand up to Marcos Ackerman for portraying Massasoit so beautifully. And when I say beautifully, for me, that means that he's creating a three-dimensional person.
Well, to honor his effort on this film, tell me more about the casting of him and your work with him.
Well, that's a nice question. You know, I met Marcos Ackerman, who was a great actor. You can look him up online. And at the time, Marcos was 59 years old. And if you look at the physicality of this wonderful actor and person, you would never suspect that this gentleman's almost 60 years old. He's such a beautiful person in his laugh and his smile. And when you see certain scenes where they're doing the shell game, where they're teaching one of the Plymouth settlers how to play, Marcos is sitting there laughing. And you see this smile and you see this brightness, and you know he's giving the conjecture to, you know, the first Thanksgiving, in that we always think of it as this kind of oppressive thing, but in reality I think we all know that it was a celebration and that it wasn't wrought with the politics that we have now. And Marcos in that scene and in other scenes really just embodies the spirit of what I love about movies, which is the conjecture of the possibilities in that human, you know, human being.
Film director Chris Eyre. You can hear complete interviews with all of our guests on today's program, as well as read partial transcripts, and hear the entire program again at our website, peacetalksradio.com. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thank you for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.